to get our strategy ironed out. But Paul had insisted that he could not fly with Arnold to New York. He had other things to do. More important than a strategy session with me, Arnold groused to himself. He doesn't trust me. Arnold frowned with the realization that despite everything he had said to Stavanger, the new CEO still did not trust him. That's Joanna's doing, he thought. She's never liked me. All the years I tried to help her husband, and all the help I've given to young Greg, and she still hates the sight of me. Well, it's too bad for them, he said to himself as he swung out the keyboard set into the swivel table built into the plane's bulkhead beside him. He stabbed at the telephone key, and as soon as the computer's smoky female voice asked, "How may I help you, sir?" he told the phone to get Greg Masterson. His private line, he added. Greg's face appeared on the screen almost instantly, but it was only his recorded answer. With a grave smile, his image said, "I am unable to take your call right now, but please leave your name and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thank you." Nettled, fuming, Arnold blurted, "Greg, it's me, Brad Arnold. I need to talk to you now. Wherever you are, call me right..." The smiling image was replaced by a more serious Gregory Masterson III. He was sitting in front of a window that looked out on Central Park and the towers of Midtown Manhattan. "Brad, where are you?"
"I'm on my way to New York," Arnold replied testily. "Where else would I be?"
"Oh, of course." Greg looked relieved.
"I have some upsetting news."
Greg looked more amused than worried.
"Really?"
"McPherson's come up with evidence that your father was dying of prostate cancer." Greg's slightly smug smile winked off like a light turned out.
"It looks as if he committed suicide after all."
"No," Greg snapped. "That's crazy. Prostate cancer can be treated. My father wouldn't allow the cancer to go so far that it was going to kill him."
"My source in McPherson's office tells me that Paul's getting statements from half a dozen doctors who either examined your father or counseled him.
With enough money, you can get anyone to say anything.
But Paul's going to use these medical statements at the board meeting tomorrow to show that your father killed himself after all."
Greg fell silent. He glanced at his wristwatch. Then he said, "He wants to use these statements to counterbalance the video disc, is that it?"
Nodding, Arnold said, "I think he's outmaneuvered us."
Greg's expression hardened. "Even if my father had cancer, he could still have been murdered."
"That doesn't make much sense."
"Doesn't it?"
"I don't think so," Arnold said. "It doesn't seem reasonable."
"My father would never commit suicide, Brad. I know that. And so do you."
"What do you mean?"
"Whoever killed my father deserves to die."
"But you don't know that he was murdered," Arnold said.
"I know enough," said Greg. "I may not be entirely certain of who the murderer is, but I know enough to act."
"You mean at tomorrow's meeting? What do you plan to do?"
Greg looked at his wristwatch again. "Thanks for the information, Brad. It was good of you to call."
"What? Is that all you've got to say?"
"That's all you've got time for," said Greg. Arnold blinked his frog's eyes, puzzled.
"What are you talking about?
We've got to figure out some way." The plane lurched so hard that Arnold was hurled out of his seat and banged against the tabletop keyboard. The sudden pain in his middle made him feel he'd been carved in two. For an instant he hung there. Then the plane pitched up sharply, and he was thrown back into his chair.
"Seat belts!" The pilot's frantic shout came over the intercom. "We've lost power on..."
Another staggering tumble, and the plane plunged downward.
"Mayday! Mayday!" the intercom was blaring. "Lost power on both engines! Going down!"
Horrified, pinned in his seat, unable even to lift his arms, Arnold saw the steel-gray Atlantic rushing up toward him. Then a frightful shriek of tortured metal and part of the wing ripped away. He was too terrified to scream, but Greg's face on the little screen smiled grimly and said, "Goodbye, Brad." The screen went blank, and then the plane hit the water and exploded. Mare Nubium. Paul pulled himself onto the flat top of the huge boulder and lay on his belly, panting and sweating for long minutes. "Like when we used to climb up onto the roofs of the warehouses when we were kids," he thought. But he knew the difference.
Back then, he could scramble up the warehouse walls like a monkey and then spend the rest of the day running races across the flat roofs or playing hide-and-seek with his bros among the cooling towers and other structures on the roofs. He remembered the chicken game they played, jumping from one roof to the next across the alleyways separating the buildings. One slip and it was the morgue or the hospital. And the police. Good thing everything weighs 1/6 here, Paul thought. I'm sure in no shape to play tag now. Slowly, carefully, he forced himself to his knees, and then to his feet. The GPS signal was still coming through loud and clear. No tears in the suit. Probably saved half an hour, at least, he told himself. He walked across the big rock. Its top was not as flat as it had looked. It was pitted here and there with small, sharp craters, almost like bullet holes. Then Paul got to the far side. He peered over the boulder's edge. This side was much steeper than the other had been. Looks like the pissing rock was sheared off with a big cleaver. How the hell am I going to get down there? There's hardly any place for a toehold. I could jump, he thought. Only about 30 feet. But he knew that, lunar gravity or not, a man could break bones jumping that far. Paul recalled a couple of wise-asses who disregarded the safety regs when they had first started working on the moon. One broke his leg, the other his neck. How surprised the poor son of a bitch looked, even through the visor of his helmet. Died before they could get a medical team to him. So I won't jump, Paul concluded. But how the hell do I get down? Could go back the way I came. But that'd mean I'd have to walk all the pissin' way around this damn rock, just as if I never climbed up here in the first place. I'll lose an hour or more, and there's not that much oxygen left. He rummaged through the pockets on the thighs of the suit and in the pouches on the belt around his waist, looking for anything that might serve as a rope. All he found was a lot of useless junk and a 10-foot length of hair-thin wire. It was used to plug the suit's microcomputer into more powerful units when necessary. Too short and too frail, Paul thought, but it'll have to do. He jammed one end of the wire into the craterlet closest to the rock's edge, then wedged it with pebbles and bigger stones until it looked like a miniature cairn. Might mark my grave after all, he told himself. Okay, he said aloud. Down we go, one way or another. The wire held his weight, but as Paul cautiously edged his way down the sheer face of the boulder, he could feel the wire slipping out from under the rocks he had used to hold it down. He thought about rappelling, but figured that would just tear the wire loose even faster. The worst part was that he couldn't see the ground from inside his helmet. He'd have to bend over almost double to look down, and he didn't have the time or the inclination to try. The wire felt as if it were really slithering loose. Gotta jump, Paul told himself. If I don't... The toe of his left boot struck a projection. A ledge, only a few inches wide, but it felt like an interstate highway and international jetport runway put together. He found the ledge with his other boot and rested there for a moment, taking the strain off the wire. If I can just turn around, he thought. Slowly, with infinite care, he twisted his body around in a clumsy, sweaty pirouette, never letting go of the wire dangling above his head. He only got halfway turned around. The bulky backpack of his suit stopped him from going further. Still, it was enough. He leaned over slightly, judged his distance from the ground. Still hard to see. The dust was still clinging to his visor. Looks like more than 20 feet. Paul turned around again until he was facing the boulder once more. He felt the wire with both gloved hands. Only another foot or so of it left. Okay, he said to no one. Just like you're jumping off the warehouse roof. He let go of the wire, got down on one knee, planted both his hands on the ledge, then lowered his other leg over its edge. He let himself dangle for a moment, hanging onto the ledge with his fingers while he swung his boots to touch the boulder's face. Then he pushed off and fell. It was like a dream. He fell so slowly. He had time to calculate. I'm almost 6 feet tall,
and the ledge was 20 feet above the ground, so I'm really only dropping about 14 feet, and in the 1/6 G, I ought to be okay if I don't hit another ledge or a bump or projection or... His boots slammed onto the ground.